Hey guys, welcome back to the Brock Cannon Podcast. This is episode number 33. In this episode, I was able to sit down with Patricia Neubauer, who is a powerhouse triathlete who's not only crushing it in her sport, but she's finding a way to give back to less fortunate athletes in other countries and helping them to get a shot at education in the USA. Patricia has a fascinating story. She grew up in East Germany and at 7 years old witnessed the wall come down, and she tells the story in our conversation of how she literally walked around the wall, met the neighbors that lived on the other side of the wall, and said, "Hi, we've lived by you for 20 years, we're your neighbors." And just what an experience seeing that entire piece of history was. She eventually ended up in New York City where she ran track for a college and then ultimately found her true love, triathlon, in California years later. Patricia's got a huge heart. She's doing a lot with her nonprofit, and we get into all of that. And we even talk about some of the dark side of supposed sports agencies and how they're taking advantage of athletes overseas. So there's some really interesting things in this episode. I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. And without further ado, Patricia Neubauer. Hey guys, Brock Cannon here. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This is episode number 33. I am super delighted to have Patricia Neubauer with me today. Patricia lives here in Santa Barbara, not too far from me. And I'm trying to think how we even met, Patricia. Like, how did we meet? Like, just through the athletic community or the triathlon community, or how did we even know?
I think we did meet through social media and the trail running stuff on social media, Santa Barbara. I think that's how it happened, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I met you probably over a year ago, and then we've talked business stuff, and I've just been following your journey. And, you know, I'm excited to talk to you today about everything you're doing with athletes and your nonprofit and helping immigrants, because you yourself are an immigrant to this country and you have a really, really cool story. So for those of our listeners that are not familiar with you, tell us just a little bit about your background to start off.
So I was born in Germany. I grew up in Germany. And so as a kid, I was always doing like all kinds of sports, from volleyball to dancing. I was a skateboarder. I had an older brother, so I always wanted to be and to do what he does because he was my big inspiration. So I basically grew up as a tomboy trying to do everything just like him. So that made me pretty competitive already starting off. So then I went through some personal struggles at home, and in order to somehow escape that and literally run away from that, I started running. And I started running like once a week, and then I started running every 3 days, every other day, and I started to really, really enjoy it. So I'm like, this is actually cool. First of all, it helped me through whatever I was going through, and then secondly, I really enjoyed that sport. And when I timed my little route from my home around the woods and back, I got faster every time I went. So I started to think maybe I should join a club. In Germany, you don't run for a university or a school. There's no such thing. So it's not really, sports is not, unless you play soccer in Germany, sports is not really well supported, especially when it comes to high school or school. Everybody has to do sports. Like, for example, swimming is mandatory and gym is mandatory and everyone is riding the bike there anyway. So people are in general athletic, but it's not an organized sport really in the school. So I went to this running store of my then to be coach. He won the Bronx medal in 1976 in Montreal. And I went into a running store. I'm like, I am Pat. I run 30 minutes in 5 kilometers, and I would love you to be my coach. And at that time, she's like, oh, 30 minutes, it's pretty good. But I didn't know it was, like, super slow. But like, was like, yeah, that's a really good time. So why don't you show up to our women's running group? And then we take it from there. So fast forward, I did show up. I started running with them. I started running 2 times with them, 3 times a week with them. And she saw the drive that I had and the will that I wanted to do better and better all the time. And so she was coming from a mid-distance background. So that's anything from 800 meters to 3,000 meters. And she saw my running technique and my running form and my build. And she said, I think you can be a really good mid-distance runner. So why don't I just prepare you for that? And I was like, oh, hell yeah, I'm down. I'm totally down. Like, this is awesome, right? So fast forward, we trained every day. We trained twice a day. And then, you know, over the years, we even trained 3 times a day. And I became faster and faster and faster. And I won national championships in the 800, even in the 400, in the 1500. I won cross-country championships and all that. So that became a really, really, really big part of my life during that time. Over 10 years, I trained with her.
How old were you when you started with her?
Honestly, I started really late. I started when I was about 19. So so to become a really successful runner, it was actually pretty late. I was a skateboarder and I was skating and went to the emergency room all the time because I had to get stitches and all that. So one day she said, listen, I mean, this is so frustrating for me. You always are in the emergency room. You're always injured. You have to make a decision. Either I train you and we do it, you know, all out, or I just can't. You have to make a decision. It's skateboarding or it's track.
Right. You have to choose.
Yeah. I mean, it was hard because I loved that sport. I was the only girl in my hometown doing that. It was not skateboarding. It was street boarding. So on the street board, your feet are attached to the board, like on a, snowboard. So when you go into when you skate street and you skate half pipes and mini ramps and stairs, when you fall, like, you fall hard, you know, you fall with the board. You cannot just jump off.
Yeah.
So that's why I was like always injured and always something. And she was like, I cannot train this girl when she's always like injured like that. This is ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. They don't want you injured. So let's go back just a little bit. So tell us just a little bit more about, like, the town you grew up in Germany. Was it a small town? And for those that, like, aren't even super familiar with the geography of Germany, I've been there personally. But for those that aren't, give us just a little bit of a lay of the land and tell us just a little bit about the town you grew up in.
Sure. So the town is called Potsdam. It's right next to Berlin. At the time when I was born, it was East Germany. So it was behind the wall on the quote-unquote bad side of the wall. Yeah, there's a movie out there. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Bridge of Spies. It's with Tom Hanks.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yep, and that's my hometown. So it was even shot in my hometown. So the bridge, that Bridge of Spies, connected Potsdam, East Germany, with West Germany. So at the time, I was, you know, when the wall came down, I was 7 years old. And I still remember the actual event. I remember like it was yesterday. It was insane. We had neighbors in West Germany literally behind the wall, because the house that my parents lived in, it was literally next to the wall, and they had neighbors on the west in Berlin. Wow. So when the wall came down, you know, we drove over the bridge where everybody was just crying and screaming and handing me like West German money, West German chocolate. And then we went over the bridge around the wall to literally the other side of the wall and rang on the bell and said, hey, we were your neighbors for like 30 years, but we weren't allowed to see each other. Oh, so here we are. And from that point on, we became best friends. So that was kind of crazy. But yeah, my hometown is a little it's a very historic town. The Potsdam Conference was held there, where they split Germany into the four parts after the war. And we also have a lot of castles. We have a lot of water and a lot of wood. So it's a mecca for a lot of runners too, and swimmers and canoe. And it's actually an Olympic base, that hometown, because they have an Olympic facility there where a lot of Olympic athletes come. Yeah. So for sports, it's huge. Potsdam, a lot of people know Potsdam just when it comes to sports, yeah.
That's awesome. So you were in a good spot. You've had woods to run, and that sounds like paradise to me. And then tell us, fast forward back up again. So you started getting faster and faster. Your coach was seeing progress in you. You were winning national championships, and then you were recruited by an American university to go do track and field in 2008. So tell us kind of that next step.
So yeah, first of all, I was like, since I'm super OD with everything that I do, like I don't know a gray zone. I just know black and white, right? So when my coach trained me, she basically oversaw everything from the training to the sleeping to nutrition. And I had to... I had a food journal that I had to present to her a week in advance what I eat. Because in East Germany, like the East German approach is also based on weight. So they kind of want, I know the American mid-distance runners, they're like monsters, you know, like Maria Mutola, one of these girls, like these were always like huge athletes. But if you look at the Eastern European athletes, the Russians, the Germans, the mid-distance runners, they're all skinny. So this is what it came down to, a lot of dieting. So fast forward, I kind of OD'd it. So every time, everything she wrote down I should eat, I even ate less because I wanted to weigh less than that. So I knew, like, if I weigh, you know, 110 pounds, then I can run 5 seconds faster in the 800. And if I weigh less than that, then I can be 10 seconds. But okay, it just works to a certain degree. But it's a slippery slope to become really, really sick and like really unhealthy. And unfortunately, this is what happened to me. I'm 5'7", right? And I was weighing under 100 pounds because I took it to the extreme. Like I looked like I was 19, 20. I looked like a 13-year-old. Like no muscle, no shape. Lost my period for years.
Oh, my God.
And and then I became really, really sick. I had to go to the doctor and he said, listen, your liver is swole up like a freaking soccer ball and your spleen is about to burst. So you have to stop right now. Yeah. You cannot do anything. So from that point on, I couldn't do anything for 2 years. I was like, I was not allowed to do anything. Literally, and that put me in like a really dark spot because I, over 10 years, I mean, I defined myself with that. You know, it was my identity. I am a runner. This is Patricia Neubauer. She is a runner. I had really nothing besides my study in Germany, nothing really going for me. You know, everybody knew me as that fast girl, that fast blah, blah, blah. Now, what do you do? Like, it was dark, you know? Yeah. But so I over the 2 years, I kind of crawled out of that, got back on track, and then I got recruited by an American university. I got several offers, but I decided to go to New York because I fell in love with the city and I wanted to be close to that. So that's where it happened. That was 2008. That's when it all started. Yeah,
that's awesome. So you went to New York, you started competing there. I want to pause for a second, and I warned you that I would do these rabbit trails occasionally, but I think this would be really great to get your perspective on now, because I've seen you out running a couple of times, obviously, and you look strong. Like you look anything but weak or sickly or anorexic. And, you know, I actually completely understand this because growing up as a pro cyclist, you know, it was all about trying to be as skinny as you could to go up the hills fast, this power to weight ratio. Like, I get it. And I think particularly because I've had a lot of my ambassadors with my company Prevail that are very vocal about this. They're women who at one point had eating disorders. They were taught from coaches that they needed to be very skinny, mm-hmm. and they ended up getting sick just like you. And so mm-hmm. looking back now, what would you tell your younger self, and what advice would you have for girls in particular that are so worried about the way they look and in terms of how they really should be eating for performance to be mm-hmm. optimally mm-hmm. powerful?
Yeah. I never had an image problem. Like I never had, fortunately, that problem when I looked in the mirror, I thought I'm fat. No, I literally just had a number in my head. That weight, you can run that fast. But then also if you, I was standing at the starting line of an 800 meter race and I look right and left and I'm like, oh, you know, this girl is so skinny. She might be way faster than me. Or here's this girl that has like, you know, these thighs and like, she might be way faster than me. And that's bullshit. It's like, it's so much bullshit. It's just overthinking. Like you can think yourself in this deep, deep hole. You know, somebody might have like even a little belly and they might still be faster than you. Like they could like just crush it because they're so fast. Like you can just not go off of that. It's ridiculous. I mean, you have to find a balance. You cannot be too heavy. Obviously, you carry this around the track, but geez, don't go into this extreme where it's like expected or accepted. Even commentators, you know. The commentators sometimes, if you watch a track meet, when they comment, oh, she's built a little heavier, it's like, shut up, you know? Like, she's winning these races. Shut up. You have no idea, especially what it does to women. Like, why don't they talk about men being a little bit on the heavier side? Nobody talks about that. Because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's all about your performance. Performance and your strength, and if this is your build, it's your freaking build.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. that makes me really angry. You know,
I will never forget, Pat, my very first 50K ultra marathon that I ever tried, and I still at the time considered myself a mountain bike racer, and I was just kind of doing this for a goof, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm like in pretty good shape from mountain biking. And, you know, I was fairly skinny at the time and I went out really hard, of course. And like with the lead group felt probably good for 26 miles, still mm-hmm. had just a little bit to go. Mm-hmm. And then I threw up everywhere and I went into the pain cave and I was like literally walking at the slowest speed possible. I will never forget on this hill, this girl who was probably a little younger than me, probably 30, maybe 40 pounds heavier than me, mm-hmm. just blew by me and demoralized me. I was like, all right, clearly I am the ignorant asshole here. I know nothing about nutrition with running. I'm too skinny and I'm falling apart. And I agree with everything you said. Like, it's not about the build, it is about your performance and how you feel being good, and that should be what it's about.
Yeah, totally. And you know, and injury prone to injuries. I mean, I feel great. Like I felt like I'm running on clouds and with like 100 pounds, but then I always felt miserable. I was always hungry. I was in the worst mood. I was like, I was the worst to be around. It was terrible. And then, you know, you get up in the morning, I literally, the number on the scale determined what mood I would be for that day. If I go in on the scale, first of all, I weighed myself every day. If I was like 500 gram over, I was like, started crying. I was obsessed. It was crazy. Yeah. So, and it makes you sick. It makes you sick. So you should, you know, that's what I would tell them. Just don't, I mean, to a certain point, don't eat like 5 meals for dinner, but you know, just listen. You know, the people that eat the best are kids, because kids eat when they're hungry and kids do not eat when they're not hungry, and it's just taught, like food. And at the time 6 p.m. it's dinner, that like 8 a.m. everybody needs to have breakfast, but a kid just really has the ability still to listen to their body if they're hungry or not. And we lose that because we fulfill norms and social norms and like calorie intakes and all that stuff, which is, yeah, it's we lost that inner connection.
That's very true. So fast forward to today, and you're training a lot. I mean, you're continuing to do not just running, but you're doing triathlon, everything from mm-hmm. sprint to Ironman. Mm-hmm. So you're burning a lot of calories. Walk mm-hmm. us through just a typical day for you with how you eat, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just killed half a chocolate bar, so just awesome. That on the side. No, but so usually I start off with oatmeal in the mornings, where I put some oatmeal with water, not with milk. I'm trying to get off of the dairy because it's not really in America, especially in Europe, we have different rules for dairy, right. But that's on the side. So oatmeal in the morning with banana and peanut butter, and then so I try to eat like. Not try to eat. I'm kind of hungry. This is what I have to say right now. Every 2 hours. So I try to eat a little snack every 2 hours because usually at lunch I train. If I have a heavy meal, I would just throw up in the water or something. So I have like a banana with peanut butter or, you know, another yogurt. I'm like totally down for these new coconut yogurt. Oh, yeah, they're so delicious. They're even better than the normal yogurts. And they're not, you know, dairy from dairy. They're literally from coconuts. And they're amazing. So I have that. And then I train at lunch, usually swim or run. After that, I eat, what do I eat then? Another snack, maybe some bread. I try to eat my European way now. So I go to Trader Joe's and buy European style bread. I put it in the toaster and I put an avocado on there. And yeah, that's what I usually have after training. And then I get off work. I get off work at 3, which is cool because I start early. I start at 6. I get off at 3 and do my second training session, which is usually the longer session. And then during the session, I have either a bar, a Clif Bar, or gel. And then, of course, water. And then after training, I usually have a salad and chocolate again. I always, you know, I will never just deprive myself from that. Now, if I feel like it, I eat it.
What's your favorite kind of chocolate?
So there's this brand from Germany. It's called Rittersport, and they have that in Trader Joe's too now. It's the little square. Yeah, they have different. Trader Joe's offers like 8 flavors. If you go to Germany, if you go to a grocery store in Germany, you can choose from 35 flavors of that chocolate. It's amazing.
Awesome.
So I usually choose the one with the cookie inside. it's the Rittersport with the cookie inside. It's so damn good. Yep.
Awesome.
So yeah, I try to eat again when I'm hungry. Sometimes I even skip dinner if I'm not. Maybe if I had like somebody, you know, was baking a cake at the for the office and I had it. So I'm like, it's not that I had the cake. I cannot eat dinner. It's like, no, I had the cake. I'm not hungry. I don't need to eat. So that's.
You're just listening to your body.
Oh, yeah. And it took me years. Jeez, man. 20 years or something to be able to do that. It was crazy. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. And I think everyone always appreciates, you know, just being walked through an actual day. That's phenomenal. So
thanks.
Tell us how you transitioned into triathlon, and then I'd love to kind of hear, you know, what do you love most about it? But tell us how you transitioned into that just from running initially.
So I lived in New York for almost 10 years. New York is not really a triathlon town. It's more about gym here, gym there. So I went to the gym, of course, and I actually competed in bodybuilding. I was a bikini bodybuild competitor. And again, that was like all about restriction. It was crazy. But then when I came to Santa Barbara, I bought myself a bike, a road bike. So I started riding a little bit around town. And then I'm like, I really like this. Maybe I should start. I mean, I run anyway a little bit. At that time, I was like out of shape because I just did weights. So I'm running a little bit anyway. I think I ran like a 10-30 mile or something. It was the best I could do at that time. Yep. And so my landlord actually knew my current coach because he coached his wife. So he referred me to him, and then we connected, and I said, I think I want to start triathlon. And that was literally 8 weeks out of this big Santa Barbara triathlon. So it was like, sure, we're going to start training now, and you're going to do the long course Santa Barbara triathlon. I'm like, what? That's in 8 weeks. That's almost like a half Ironman distance. That's insane. And he was like, oh, I've seen your social media. You're an athlete. You can do that. I believe in you. I'm like, okay. So that's when I started triathlon. And yeah, well, that was my first full triathlon race was the Santa Barbara Tri.
That's awesome. And so, you know, you had experience running, obviously. You started with the biking. When did you start swimming? And I'd like to also know which do you feel like is your favorite of the three, if you have a favorite?
So Germans swim all the time. Like, first of all, it was mandatory in school swimming. So we have to swim when we are third grade. Like, they throw you in the water, you got to swim. And then I studied sports in Germany. I have a degree in sports science, and swimming was one also of the mandatory courses. So I was pretty, and then in the mornings, every morning when I woke up before school, I went to swim across the lake in Germany. So swimming was always, you know, a natural thing to do. So that was easy. But so I think my favorite was the bike, because coming from a track background where it's all about power,
yeah,
and not really efficiency, much more about power, I could easily translate that into the pedal. And I realized, you know, starting to compete and riding with other people, that I'm faster than them. But it came easy to me, you know. I think it's when that one sports talent just discovers, you know, when they're a little kid, that some people just kill themselves, and meanwhile you just easily surpass them. And that's when I realized, I think bike is going to be actually my strongest in the whole triathlon. Yeah,
well, and probably the best, because it's typically the longest, right?
Yeah, it's an advantage for sure. I mean, it's good to be a good runner or an average good runner, but since it's the longest of the entire course, it's always a huge advantage. Because if you, let's say, if you make up 5 to 10 minutes on the bike, it's really hard to make that up on the run or having somebody pass you. If right. you think about it, like a 5 minute get in running is huge. It's huge.
Right.
So it's almost impossible. So I always try to literally kill myself on the bike, go all out, and then just try to see what's left on the run. And usually it's enough to win.
Yeah, that's awesome. I am nowhere near the triathlete you are, Pat. I did like sprints and a couple trail triathlons like in the fall after my mountain bike season used to be done. Yeah. And oh my God, I would literally be like the last person out of the water. I'd be like nearly drowning, but then I would like hop on the bike and I would just like try like hell to get up to the front. And then I would try to survive the run.
Yep.
And sometimes I could still get on the podium, but like I agree with you. The bike seems to be the most crucial, and for sure. And I mean, I don't know. You definitely want to have more swimming skills than me. I promise you. So anyway, well, fantastic. So you're crushing that. What do you have your eye on next? Do you have any races coming up? What are you setting your sights on right now with triathlon?
So I tried all distances now, from sprint to Xterra, which is all off-road triathlon, to actual Ironman. And I finished the season on a high with the sprint triathlon, which was, I think, the best triathlon I've ever done in my entire life. So being that successful in this last triathlon and being not so successful in like the long distance ones, I talked to my coach and told him, I think I will be, I'm better in the shorter distances, from sprint to Olympic, also with my track background, I think, over the years. And he said, I mean, he's incredible. He would just, if I say I want to do Ironman, he would make me the best Ironman. If I do sprints, he would make me the best sprinter. It doesn't really matter to him. But yeah, it also makes sense with, you know, I mean, training for an Ironman, it's like, it's a part-time job. I trained like 25 hours a week. Like, there was nothing else to do besides, if you have a full-time job and training for an Ironman, it's insane, you know? So in order to keep some sanity and some social life and working on my other businesses, and being that successful in the shorter distance, we're just going to concentrate on shorter ones now, sprint and Olympic distance. This is what it's going to be for next year. So great. Yeah, I'm super excited about that for sure.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Yeah. So I want to get into what you are doing with athletes and your nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And obviously I'm pretty aware, because Prevail has offered to step up, which, you know, we need to follow up on that. I'm ready anytime to help.
Dope. Yeah.
So tell us about what you're doing and how this was inspired. And just let's start from the beginning. Tell everyone the name of the nonprofit and what you are up to there, because it's very cool.
Thank you. So yeah, it's called New Power Athletic Consulting. It's called New Power because my last name is Neubauer. And then, you know, my business partner in Kenya, to whom I will get in a bit, said, Neubauer, you New Power, you're the New Power. So this is how it started. New Power Athletic Consulting. And our tagline is education through athletic skills, not dollar bills.
I love it.
Yeah, it's a little bit, I'm a big Wu-Tang fan, and one of the managers and Wu-Tang affiliates told me, you have to make that, like, you have to make the thing. I was thinking about education through athletic skills, not funding or something. He said, no, make it the dollar bills, you know, dollar bills, you know. So that's how it started. So basically, I am helping underprivileged kids in Africa, mostly Africa. I mean, fast forward, it could probably expand. But help them to get a sports scholarship in the United States. And I'm focusing on runners right now, because this is my background too, and I know most about that sport. So yeah, that's what I do.
That's fantastic. So, you know, In terms of discovering these athletes, how are you finding out about them, or are they just finding out about you? How does that process work?
Yeah. So let me back up a little bit to explain to you why this was inspired. Just real quick. So if you are an athlete, a good athlete in wherever you're from, I mean, it happened to me. There's sports scholarships available in the United States, from full scholarships to partial scholarships to academic scholarships. But if you are a good athlete, you have the opportunity to get a full ride at a university. I mean, this is huge. They pay for everything. They pay for room and board, and you train with them and you compete with them. That's basically the only exchange. I mean, you also have to maintain a certain GPA. But so here are these kids in Kenya that are smart and that are fast. And on the other side, you have the universities that would love to have these kids. But then how do these kids get to the United States? It's a gap that needs to be bridged because they don't know how. And they are so-called sports agencies on the market. These sports agencies offer consultation. They offer conversation with the coaches. They offer preparation for the SAT and the TEFL test, which is a language test. But the hook is they charge $3,000 and up. $3,000 is the minimum entry, $9,000 per person if you want to have the VIP treatment. Wow. So how on earth is a Kenyan family able to afford this when they maybe make $5 a year to just survive, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when I came into place and start this and be the middleman, help them to go from point A to B. So I'm the contact for all these universities. I have over 50 universities on board with me that welcome this project. They love this project. And I'm setting up the infrastructure in these African countries. So I went to training camps in Kenya when I was an athlete in Germany. So high altitude training. I mean, this is big for endurance runners. So I went to Eldoret in Kenya, which is, you know, the running town next to Eton. There's this another place called Eton. It was a big, big popular training camp. So I set up my network already there. I knew the people. And when all this started, I reached out to one of them via Facebook. He his name is Justin Lagarde. He's a professional runner, and he's also an online coach for running. And yeah, he totally welcomed the idea. And he is the contact person for about 10 to 15 kids in Kenya that, you know, he will mentor and prepare and train. And at the same time, we set up the contact for the educational facility that will tutor the kids and that will do the SAT test and the language test for them, so they are certified and they get these numbers that the coaches in the United States want to see, obviously. So the infrastructure is there. Everything is there. I mean, we're ready to roll, basically, but we need the startup money. We need funding, you know. We cannot just... Right now, I'm even, you know, it's frustrating with all this paperwork for the nonprofit, and, you know, it takes more time, so I have to pay stuff out of my pocket for a business license because the nonprofit is not finally approved. There's another month, and so it's like, ugh, this is so frustrating. If I could have help somewhere, because I'm doing this all by myself, I mean, that would be amazing.
Well, let's see how we can get the word out. So, you know, what would you say if we were just to throw this out to our listeners and to everybody else in the universe here to just kind of get things rolling properly? How much would we need to raise?
I mean, I think as a startup baseline, I think $50,000.
Okay.
But you know, it's hard. I mean, nonprofit is hard. You know, people do not really, I mean, it's harder to ask for money for people for like a cause rather than an exchange for something materialistic,
but
it's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think it's a phenomenal project, and you know, I'm going to certainly do what I can help to get the word out. And
thank that's you, man. Why
we've got this going here. You know, tell us a little bit more. What was Kenya like? You know, tell us about these people and the conditions that they're kind of born in, and how. You know, what did you observe there? What was your biggest aha moment when you were actually in Kenya running with these runners there?
I mean, I swear, if you can do anything for yourself or your kids or whatever to get some perspective on the world or on yourself, is you have to travel to one of these countries, because that puts things so much in perspective, and that tells you how good you have it, and all these worries that you worried about are just little peanuts. Definitely do travel if you can. So that's my basic advice. But so these kids and these runners, they run to survive. It's not a joke. They literally run to survive. I talked to one of the biggest coaches out there. He's a pastor. His name is Father Colm. He's from Ireland, but decided to just move out to Kenya and train these kids and build schools and all that. And I mean, I asked him, what is the difference? Why are the Kenyans are the best runners in the world? Tell me more. I want to know, why can Europeans not bypass them? And he told me, you have to see it as a certain cake. You know, a cake has certain pieces and every piece has a certain percentage. So obviously, first of all, it's the high altitude. That's one. Secondly, it's genetics. They have a different biomechanics, true. But also, yeah, it's not a big percentage. The biggest percentage of them being so good is the motivation. This is the only way they have to get, first of all, to even get out of their country, maybe, and feed their families. I mean, a Western European or Western civilized person, they just go home to their freaking PlayStation. I mean, why would they even want to work harder? We have everything we want. We have everything we want. So, and that's how they train. I mean, they go on a run. They go on a run with 50 people, right? They go on a run with 50 people for a 50K run.
Wow.
And they tell themselves, if they do not eat and do not drink anything during the 50K, they're going to become the best runners in the world. So imagine this, like they started with 50 people. They start racing, not racing, training with 50 guys, and they end up with 20. Because obviously the other 30 are dehydrated or malnutrition and wrong. But of those 20, he says, or I tell you, I guarantee you, you will see at least one of them in the Olympic Games. It's like a box of chocolate, like a box of pralines. You pick one and you send them to the Olympic Games or to the World Championships. But then if this guy's done, you just pick another one. It's plenty there. Plenty. And, you know, the way they train too, it's like they don't wear well, first of all, they run barefoot. Like, they don't really believe in shoes. So even if they have, like, sponsors that they need to show off, usually it was a Fila or Kappa during these big races. They have to, like, they warm up in those shoes and they show the jack a little bit. But when the gun gets off, they just take it off, put some chalk on their feet, and they just race barefoot. I mean, that's what they're used to, you know? And then, you know, they don't wear watches. So they used to run in the backyard of the training camp in packs of, like, two or three. Based on the performance level. So the coach pairs them. And then the coach stands in the middle of the field with a whistle. And he whistles. And when he whistles, the kids have to go as fast as they can. But they don't know when he's going to whistle again. Because when he whistles again, they can stop. But they don't know that. He could whistle in 10 seconds. He could whistle in 5 minutes. So all they do is, like, they just go all out for... who knows how long, you know? And then also, I mean, just these people have nothing, you know? They live off of potatoes and live in little tents and tikis, and they are the happiest people I've ever seen in my entire life. The happiest. And it made me feel so terrible. It made me feel embarrassed. It made me feel... like, what am I even thinking, you know? I get upset if I don't have the Snickers bar at the cashier. Are you kidding me?
Right.
You know, they have nothing and they're just so happy. And then, you know, when you train in the altitude, you know, usually for 2 weeks, you have to go down to zero for 1 week to get the red blood cells going. So we went down to zero in Mombasa into a all-inclusive hotel, you know. And then after coming from this poor high-altitude training camp down to the all-inclusive hotel and you see all these people like going to the buffet thinking like the world ends tomorrow if they don't get this another cake. I mean, that made me like so like, ugh, so disgusted, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. And I think, you know, you hear similar stories sometimes from people who go to India and they're like, don't go to India unless you're ready for a complete mind shift. Like,
yep.
It's just out of control. I mean, that makes sense. Like, you see these Kenyans that go to the States or to other Western countries and just absolutely give it their all. And they're trying, obviously, to win prize money. Well, I just Googled this just because I wanted a reference point. This is a little dated, but, you know, a few years ago, the average salary in Kenya, it said, was about $80 a month. So you figure they're going and winning a race. I don't know what the purse of like the New York Marathon is or, you know, the Boston, but even take something smaller like the Salt Lake City Marathon. They're earning enough money to feed their families for probably a few years, right?
Well, here's the problem, which a lot of people don't know. This whole sending Kenyans to European races is extremely corrupt. You see these Kenyans on the podium of whatever race you want to reference. You see them holding the check. You see them all happy. You see them with the amazing ASICS shoes. What you don't see is that when they are sent back to their country, they get stripped off their shoes. They get stripped off their jackets. They get stripped off the winning money. They're sent home with maybe $10 if they're lucky. It's an organized mafia of sports scouts, sports talents. They go to the Kenyan families. They say, hey, I want your guy, Justin here, I give you $5. Can I please bring him to Europe to run a race? And these families are, you know, excited. I mean, this guy's giving me $5. He's going to bring my kid. Yeah, they let him go. But this prize money is not for them. It's not for them. And it's the saddest thing to see and to experience myself because it's not true. But if they can get an education, you know, if they can use that athletic talent plus an education, get a degree in the United States, which they can use either even they stay in the United States or they can bring it back to the country and do something like out of, you know, unheard. That would help. That would be sustainable. Everything else is a mafia and it's sick. Wow. It's sad. Unless your name is Paul Tergat or Haile Gebrselassie, you know, these people are years and years of experience and success. But other than that, it's corrupt as hell. It's crazy.
Wow. I had no idea about that. That's extremely sad. These agents are basically like a mafia. They're promising a lot and then they're taking the lion's share of the winnings. Wow.
And what happened? Yeah.
And someone needs to do a documentary on that, Pat, don't you think? That's crazy. We got to expose these people.
Yeah, a lot of people have no idea. And what happens a lot, too, is that the country Dubai and Qatar, they buy Kenyans and have them run for their country, but with the requirement that they have to change their name to an Islamic name. For example, Stephen Chirono, a Kenyan-born Kenyan runner, was bought by Qatar to run for Qatar. He now is Said Saif Shaheen. Originally, wow. Stephen Chirono, and Said Saif Shaheen is earning a lot of money because Qatar is paying him. I mean, I understand you're coming from a poor, poor, poor background, but at the same time, he's training in Kenya, but the Kenyan government is denying him, basically. They say, listen, you betrayed us. You changed your name, you changed your everything, your roots, and you want to train here? We don't want you anymore. We don't want you. Go back to Qatar. You want that? Do that, but... It's a huge thing. Huge.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that either. Yeah. Wow. So, mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot, and I think the bottom line with this is coming back to your nonprofit. That seems to be the most logical route for these athletes to not only have an opportunity to excel in their sport, but to also get that education, because then should something happen to the sport or there's corruption, they've got that education to fall back onto. So
exactly.
I think that's awesome. Well, fantastic. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have links, Pat, to, you know, your website, of course. You know, are you taking donations on the website? What is the best way for people out there that are listening to help or to get involved?
You know, now I was thinking over the last weeks, maybe I should, I will start a GoFundMe for, you know, the individual person that just wants to contribute, but cannot maybe contribute as much, but still wants to help. I will create a GoFundMe link on there for these people. If somebody, if a company, a brand or whatever is interested, just to, you know, go to my website and just click on the contact button where you will be directed to my email inbox right away, and I will get back to you ASAP.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds awesome. I definitely think having some buttons on there eventually to contribute is a great idea. And I hope people get involved in that. And then for people to follow your journey, what's the best way for people to reach out and say hello?
You can follow me on my social media. Instagram, for example, I am Pat Neubauer, PatNeubauer. Or my website, www.newpower.org, or friend me on Facebook, Patricia Neubauer. All these channels, I'm there.
Any of the channels. Okay, fantastic. And I'll have links on our show notes to where people can click and follow you and say hello. So
cool. Yeah. Also, Trader Joe's chocolate aisle, a big target for me too. I will be found there as well.
Can they donate in chocolate? Is that
yeah? Oh my gosh! Heaven. Yeah.
We know the way to make you happy. It is that chocolate, apparently. So awesome! And I'm sure all the athletes would love chocolate. Why not? So, well, fantastic. Well, Patricia, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. It's been a pleasure. You brought up a lot of points, I think, for all of our listeners to think about and. You know, just a lot to be grateful for, you know, and seeing the things that you've seen and going to these countries and realizing that we all are very, very fortunate indeed. And
for sure.
A lot to be grateful for. Even on our worst days, we have a lot to be grateful for.
Exactly.
Yeah, I appreciate all that.
Thank you so much for partnering with Neubauer too. I really appreciate it big, big time. This is awesome, Brock.
Yeah, my pleasure. All right, you guys, well, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you on the next episode, and I'll have all the links on the show notes where you guys can follow Pat and say hello. Thanks, you guys. Have an awesome day. I hope you guys got as much out of that episode as I did. If anything, I was really touched by her experience in Kenya and just hearing about those athletes over there and just how incredibly grateful they are. So maybe if anything in this episode, you can look at your own life and just say, wow, I've got so much to be grateful for, even on a bad day. So if you guys have enjoyed this episode, go ahead and feel free to follow Patricia. We've got links in the show notes to her Instagram, her Facebook, and of course her nonprofit. Go ahead and say hello, give some support. She's trying to raise funds for this. Let's see if we can make it happen and make dreams of all these athletes come true. If you guys have enjoyed the podcast, as always, share it and rate us so that we can be seen in more places. And I will see you guys on the next episode. Peace.